Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We've got a very cool guitar player here down with me in Florida. He's actually on the other side of the state, Tim Mitchell. He's a Grammy winner. He's got about, 200 platinum and gold records on the back of his studio. He's got a SoundCloud. All this and more on today's show. A couple of quick announcements. I want to thank our mutual friends, John DeFaria and Greco Barato, for connecting us. We appreciate it. Thank you, guys. And also, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. If you are already watching this on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button and the little emoji that looks like a bell that really helps us out on the YouTube algorithms. All righty, Tim Mitchell. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, began playing guitar at the age of 9, and by 11, he was spending all his free time practicing and immersing him in all kinds of music, from Zeppelin to jazz great Pat Martino to Segovia. He attended Interlochen Arts Academy when he was 14, majoring in music composition. If you don't know, that's a very, exclusive. It's like not exclusive in terms. It's for really high caliber, talented young kids in Michigan. He then went on to University of Miami, which also has one of the great music programs in the country, especially back then for jazz, where he majored in studio music and jazz. Over the course of his career, he's worked with the pop group Exposé and has either co-written, performed, or produced Bob Seger, Emilio and Gloria Estefan, Ricky Martin, Roberto Carlos, Wyclef Jean, and many others. He also worked with Emilio Estefan writing and producing songs for Gloria, Paulina Rubio, Thalia, John Secada, Ricky Martin, Mandy Moore, and others. Emilio also introduced Tim to Colombian artist Shakira, and they connected immediately. He was her guitarist and musical director, and they promoted her album Donde Están Los Ladrones. What does that mean? Where's the
thieves?
Where's the what?
The thieves.
Where's the thieves? Okay, I thought it
meant the robbers.
Okay, where's the robbers? After that, did you ever figure that out by the end of the tour, where the robbers were?
We actually, that whole thing, we didn't really tour on that. We did a bunch of promo stuff on that. That was back in like 98. And that was her second album. And I didn't work on that album. That's when we met and I was helping her do promo gigs and that kind of thing. And then after that, we did the MTV Unplugged album.
Yeah, which was huge.
That did well, and it was a lot of fun as well.
I'm going to ask you some questions about that. Tim was her guitarist and musical director. Then he put a band together for her, as he said, the upcoming MTV Unplugged album. He produced the album, and it went on to win the Grammy for Best Latin Pop Album and was nominated in multiple categories in Latin Grammys, including Album of the Year and Best Pop Record. And the album is considered to have paved the way for Shakira's successful English crossover. Shakira and Tim also wrote songs for the multi-platinum Laundry Service record, including the worldwide smash Whenever, Wherever, and Suerte, which became BMI's Song of the Year. Tim continued working with Shakira both in the studio and live over 4 records, as well as producing the music for her 3 DVDs and for her 3 World Cup finals performances. Tim recently was music director for legendary Brazilian artist Roberto Carlos for his Primera Fila.
Primera Fila.
Thanks. I was scared to death to read this, which was recorded at Abbey Road Studios. We're done. I'm done.
I think you covered it all.
Yeah, man. He's a badass. He's done a lot of work in Miami and with the artists there and in Latin America. He's super talented, does a lot of producing, co-writing, and he's one of the Mac Daddies down in Dade. All right. After graduating Interlochen, you went to University of Miami. And thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Exposé, the pop group, they asked you to become their guitarist, go out on tour with them, which you did, and you also became MD for a while. How did that first connection come about, and since this was your first like big tour, I was curious what were some of the more important things you learned about touring and about the business in general?
Well, that tour came about, basically they did a cattle call audition kind of deal, I think all over, you know, New York and LA and Miami. And so I was actually going to school at the time at U of M, and someone told me about it. So I went and auditioned, and then they kept kind of whittling it down. And then they kind of put bands together in the final round. I think there were three maybe. So the band I was in, the version I was in, I think most of us ended up getting the gig. And then a couple others came in from other, you know, put together bands that they did. Hmm. And then, yeah, then we literally, I mean, it just fell in like right after the semester of school ended. We started rehearsing. We did a summer tour, and it lasted probably maybe a year or something.
Was that your last year? Was that your graduating year, or did you miss school or drop out of
school? No, I basically left school to do the tour and that kind of thing, because I still had one semester left. So I never graduated. But
one thing I've noticed, it's pretty consistent. When you get involved with something, you might come in as a guitar player. You're writing music shortly afterwards. You're producing. You're MD. So there's certain skill sets and interest in assuming more responsibility that you obviously enjoy.
Right. I mean, I like that a lot. I think one of the greatest things about, if you're a guitar player and you get the gig in a band or something, you've got access to the artist. So if you're a songwriter as well, you've got the artist's ear more than all the songwriters out there pushing songs through their publishers or whatever. Yeah. So you're right there and you've got this chance to write with them. So in pretty much every situation I was in, I tried to write and produce if possible. And, you know, being the MD just it's kind of easy for me, and it just, it's something I kind of fell into, and it pretty much did a bit with Exposé and some other groups. And then with Shakir, it's been, you know, 21 years or something.
How do you do that though? Like, you know, you said you have access to the artist because you're a guitar player, but it's still, they're not interested in you writing songs, but how do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean,
like the average guy can't say, hey,
check out this riff.
Yeah. I had a great idea for a song for us.
And it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Because the artist is in tour mode. They're like, I already wrote the album. Now we're going out to promote it. Okay. So shut up.
Yes.
And let me just work on the tour. I can't focus on that. So with,
you are a promoter, man. See, you tell me you're not, but if you're doing this,
you know, you find those moments.
Right.
With Shakira, I would, in the very beginning, I mean, from when I met her, you know, we'd finish a rehearsal. Originally, basically, Emilio Estefan was her manager, and he was using the Miami Sound Machine to back her on a bunch of promo gigs. So I was part of that band. That's how I met her. And we were both like the same kind of music. She was into rock. She was into Zeppelin and Blur and all these, you know, Radiohead stuff I loved.
Yeah.
So, you know, when rehearsal would wind down and some of the guys in the band are just dying to get out of there, they're like, take off. So I kind of would hang out with her and talk, and we'd, you know, I'd play a little guitar, and she'd be like, hey, what is that? And, you know, consciously I'm thinking of, you know, trying to write something with her. And that's kind of how that happened. But she's a very creative person.
Yeah.
So, and at that time, you know, she was just always into it, like always into creating. So it wasn't so much like, oh, we're working on the tour right now. It was kind of like, oh, that's cool. Let's try something, or let's. And then it took, you know, months. Basically, I just opened that door. And then when it came time for her to start writing for an album, then I was, you know, Emilio basically would have us write together.
And okay, so you kind of had him as her manager. You had his endorsement.
Exactly, because he started managing me as well. So
okay.
And that was kind of after the Gloria tour, and this was in, I think, 2000 when we started, or 99, I think. We did the Unplugged album, and then Laundry Service was the English crossover thing, and that's when we started writing a bunch together. So,
okay. That is interesting what you said, that he was managing you as well. And I don't mean this with any disrespect towards him, but he obviously said, hey, I want to manage you, because he saw that you were a source of income. I don't mean that in any wrong way, but that you had.
That's why you should. I mean, that's why, if I was a manager, I'd think the same way.
So he said, hey,
I had cuts already with some other artists, like I think with Emilio. So,
okay, so you had a history.
Carlos Ponce had an album. I had a few songs with him. And after that is when I signed with Emilio as, you know, my manager. So, and the thing, I was kind of the old, I was like the gringo who played, you know, I had rock and roll roots. I'm from Detroit. So I kind of brought in a little different flavor.
Yeah.
Into that world. And then when that whole Latin boom was taken off, we were trying to, the whole thing was kind of like, what, you know, let's blend different styles and blend, you know, different things. The thing I did, this track for Carlos Ponce, who was on EMI, and Emilio was in charge of the project, but I did a thing where I basically had like Latin percussion, and then I had like, you know, I did a slide guitar thing on acoustic, like a dobro kind of thing, just to, which at the time seemed, you know, kind of different and mm-hmm. strange and big chorus.
Yeah. You don't usually hear a dobro in Latin music.
Right. So anyway, it was that kind of thing. And I think after that, he saw, you know, a good opening with Shakira, because that was kind of, Shakira really was into, you know, British rock, American rock, and I was as well. And he knew that we had kind of hit it off already. So it was kind of, I guess, you know, it was a good fit.
Yeah. That's really interesting how that happened, man. Thank you. I don't know how those things, it's just people seeing skill sets, talents, and opportunities and putting them together. I mean, that was really clever for everybody. And it was a win for everybody.
Yes.
That's what's cool about it. You know, it wasn't like, I hope I didn't come across like that. It wasn't a win for Emilio. It was a win for everybody, you know, and he was smart enough to see that and put it together, which was cool.
I think so. And, you know, there's always a lot of variables that come into play, and you never know. I mean, we probably wrote 20 songs and, you know, four of them got on the album kind of thing. And same with Seeger. Like, we must have written 15 songs and three of them got on. Basically. So
that's so cool. I'm gonna ask you about Seeger in a minute. That early tour with Exposé, sorry, I don't want to get off course.
Sure.
What did you learn about either the music business or touring itself? What kind of lessons did you take away from that?
For me, it was amazing. I mean, my first tour, you're making a little bit of cash and you're on a tour bus and you're playing shows all the time, the guitar's in your hand all day. You know, that was you know, you had a roommate, we were rooming, you know, back then you're like, you know, 22 years old and touring the world. And plus we did a whole promo run before the tour. So we're in LA quite a bit, staying at the Le Parc or whatever, and doing limos to various TV shows. And so for me, first, it was incredible. And I think, I mean, the thing I learned a lot, and I think everyone learns, is that there's a lot of great players out there for sure that could do any gig, but once you're on the road and you're spending all day with these people and that kind of thing, I think personality and attitude become 90% of what's important, you know, because if you've got, you know, someone who kind of rubs everyone the wrong way, it just, it's no fun.
Let me ask you a question about that. The thing I always find interesting about that in talking to musicians is you don't always have a guy that's 20, 21 that's got a good personality and attitude. It's hard for, you know, you're still young, you know. How do you, and I mean, there are people, maybe you're one of them that just, you know, were naturally bubbly and effusive and knew how to get along, but most people that age don't, or a good chunk of them don't. How does that, like, how do you learn how to do that? Or were you just a natural at it? Like, did you have those skills?
No, I mean, I don't say that I'm not a natural at anything, I don't think. Everything takes work. But, and I don't know that the age has that much to do with it. You know, there's people, you know, that you're in high school with or whatever, and there's people you click with and people you don't. There's people that you get along with. And, you know, I was in bands, and I'm sure you were as well from when you're in junior high school, and there's, you know, that dynamic between all the individuals. It's never perfect.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, you know, I mean, you hear about the Eagles and a million groups, and they're just, you know, it's like, so, but it's different if, like, with a group like that, they're all the artists. So they're like, you know, they can have egos. But if you're a side man, you really, you know, you can't afford to have a big ego. You've got to, you know, you should be a team player,
yeah,
and, you know, try to have fun and make sure that you bring it all every time you guys perform, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew from being in band, like, when did you get the hip to the vibe that, hey, because I've talked to a lot of guys and they said, hey, one of the mistakes I made early in my career was I'm up on stage and there's 10,000 people there. And the day I realized that they weren't there to see me is the day I started serving my, you know, like, holy shit, this isn't about me. And I became, you know, a better person. You know, I knew my place and I was able to take care of my business better. Was there,
it's
like,
funny because at that age, when you're young and you get on a gig like that, you want to be up front. You want the solo. You want all these things. And as you get older, you're just like, don't care.
Right.
Chair under the stage. Want to hide me?
Yeah.
No problem.
I'm good. Yeah.
But in the beginning, that is a big deal. Because I've worked with people and they'll promise you things. Like, if I'm the MD and they will promise me things, you know, we'll put the arrangement together like meticulously. You know, and with an artist like Shakira, she parts need to be played, you know, like the record. You spend a lot of time making a record. You figure those parts are important. It's not just like, yeah, it's kind of like this, right? It's not kind of like anything.
Yeah.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
So that's always a starting point for me. Start with the record. Learn the record. Learn everything note for note. And then we can take off from there and start changing things if the artist is into that. But it's tough and you can go through rehearsals and everything's cool. But then, like you said, you put some of these people in front of a crowd and they can't help themselves.
Right.
And then what the hell's going on? What, you know, and then the artist who's used to hearing, you know, certain things, they don't need to be distracted.
Right.
And Seeger was the same way, man. With Seeger, it was like, play it the way he's used to hearing it. Don't, you know, pull his ear. Like, what's going on? You know, make the artist comfortable. It's not you. Is your name on the ticket? No. So, not you, and it's never going to be you unless you put your own band together. So, but that is, it's a thing. Some people, they can't help themselves. They're like, it's like, what happened? Oh, you know, I'm sorry. Just, you know, I was in the moment. Dude.
What the fuck? What the fuck? Was Mark?
So, I mean, discipline, discipline, I think, is important.
Yeah.
Stick to the parts. And then when you're, you know, when it's like, hey, you know what? Don't worry about the part. Go nuts. Do your thing. Have fun. Then go for it.
Sure. But, which doesn't happen much in a pop gig, I would imagine.
No, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, with COVID and everything, for instance, because we can't have audiences, we can't have anything, right?
Yeah.
However, sports, they can do it without an audience and a TV audience.
Isn't that weird? Have you watched the game with no audience? I haven't.
Yeah.
What did you watch?
Like, they've got little paper people up there, some of them.
Like on baseball, right?
Basketball. Baseball, behind the batter's cage, they've got like little pictures of people. It's really weird. And some of them are piping in audience. I heard like on, European football. Interesting. But with sports, the outcome of every game is different.
Yeah, Well, the audience, yeah, you don't need to have an audience an event.
You can unquote. you can put a sporting event together and have a whole run of 20, however many games, and it's going to be different every time. But with music, and this goes back to what you were saying, you basically strive to do the same show as good as you can do it, as well as you can do it every night.
Yeah.
So the only thing that's different is the audience.
Right.
So it's not like you can, oh, we're going to do TV, you know, we're going to put a tour together and televise 120 dates. It's
yeah.
the same show.
Right.
You know, unless, I mean, obviously there's, you know, you could do it differently, but then you'd have to really make a conscious effort to make each show different. So I'm sure like someone like Billy Joel or Springsteen or, you know, these guys could do a bunch of different shows.
Well, because of the depth of their catalog. Yeah.
But the essence of when you're in rehearsals and you rehearse for 6 weeks and then you go into production rehearsals and you've got cues and cameras and everything. And in the pop world, you know, I'm constantly cueing things and doing a million things that are very mechanical. So it's hard to, I mean, that's where COVID is killing.
Yeah.
It's you know,
everything.
The music industry.
Yeah.
At least the live performance industry.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, you know.
All these, so you're a guy who has a lot of different roles, right? Like you wear a lot of different hats. And it seems like you thrive on that. Like even your energy level in talking to me is like ramped up, which is, you know, you can see you're like, that's your thing, man. You like it. What do you, is there one thing you like the best? And also if you're comfortable, is there something like you like fucking hate that you just have to do every time?
Well, is there something I like to do the best? I think you're right. I like wearing a lot of different hats because I like being in the studio. I like producing. I like writing. And all those things are different. And I like MDing tours because I know what to do. It's just it's an easy role for me. I'm used to it. So different artists, I can do it. And I've done TV as well. So I'm not sure if I have like one preference. I like mixing it all up, basically. But I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that is. Is there anything you don't like doing? Like, is there one aspect of your roles that you're like, let me get this out of the way, or let me save it for the end? Or
I'm kind of jealous of songwriters who just write the song and don't, you know, and this is just. Because if you're a producer and a programmer or whatever, and I do a lot of that, that's kind of like, oh, we just spent, you know, 3 hours writing this song. Great. Now can you put it together? And, yeah. Well, and you know, I love being the guy who's just writing the song and then walks away and makes the same amount of money as the guy who has to, you know, put the whole track together.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I mean, I love doing it, but.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be, you wouldn't mind. Choosing, yeah.
You have to pick and choose which ones you're going to spend the time on, or you hire someone to do it. And there's guys who are super fast anyway. So,
yeah.
But that's one thing that, you know, I'm a little jealous of.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
But it's my fault. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be Mutt Lang. I wanted, you know, to be, you know, Babyface and these guys who write and produce.
And, right. And you're doing it.
And program.
Yeah. And that's what you're doing.
You know, but when I program stuff, I start to toil. I toil and, some guys are like boom, 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 and it's done. I'm more like.
But you're a musician too. That's why.
Takes a long time.
Because
I just think I'm slow.
No, I think you probably have the. You're listening differently because you are. You can also be responsible for the sounds. You understand that, so you know. I think you're probably just listening differently.
Maybe. I mean, I always like to try to do something interesting.
Yeah.
If possible.
Of course. Hell yeah.
Bend the rules and that kind of thing, you know?
Fuck yeah. I'm all for bending the rules. Okay. After a while, you moved out to LA. What prompted that move? And once you got there, what did you do how did you find work?
Yeah, good question. I was always going to, you know, I think leave Miami and go to LA. And I had, you know, most of my friends did the same thing, like John DeFaria. And most of the guys who I was in school with either went to New York or LA after school. It was just, so the irony there is the fact that I did go to LA and I'm back in Miami. But I, you know, I moved out there and, you know, got a roommate, an apartment, and started doing gigs. I already had friends who were already out there, so I started hooking up with them. Like, John was already out there, and I'd play gigs at, you know, Lava Lee and the Baked Potato and all these little jammy clubs and that kind of thing, and go hear amazing musicians. And, you know, it wasn't easy, because I think, like, most of the money, like, I made with the expose, then I just poured that into gear, of sure. course. So
shocking.
I think that I did a gig. Someone told me Barry Manilow was having auditions for a band. So I auditioned, and I ended up getting the gig, and he was just the greatest guy. Just, you know,
did you have that?
So cool. What a great songwriter. Just, you know, super cool. So I did that, was kind of the first gig I got when I got out there. And it was kind of funny, because during the rehearsals for that, the only downfall of Barry Manilow is he loves to rehearse. Like, he loves it. He was very strict. Like, we just rehearsed like 10 to 7 every day. But then on the road, he'd want to go to the venue and, like, rehearse all day.
Wow. So, do you know Mike Lent?
God bless him, man. He's amazing. He's so cool.
Do you know Mike Lent?
Mike Lent?
Yeah.
I think so.
That's been his guitarist. I think his name, Mike Lent, for years, like maybe 20 something years now. Maybe he came in right after you, but he mentioned that.
Well, I did it in, I think, 91. And then I got my friend Brian Monroney, who also went to U of M, to take over for me. So basically, when we were in rehearsals with Barry, we rehearsed for 5 weeks in LA. And during like the third week or fourth week, I mean, I got called, John called me to take over and do the Miami Sound Machine with Gloria, which for me was it was a big gig. She was on top.
Yeah.
Doing amazingly well. So I took that gig, and then
that was pretty cool. But now you had to move back. A little awkward,
yeah. But I did it. Then after like the first gig with Barry, I talked to Barry's MD, and I said, look, I gave him a month's notice. So I said, I got glorious gigs, I'm going to do that. And he was super cool.
That's good.
Great. And then ironically, I think when we did the switchover, we were in New York, Barry's playing the Paramount and Gloria's playing the Garden.
That's so cool.
Same building, same night. And literally my gear went, instead of going into Barry's trucks, went into Gloria's trucks.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
You couldn't have had that any better.
Yeah. It worked out. I mean, yeah, that worked out pretty well. And so, yeah, I mean.
That's cool. So you went out there, and then, so how long, you weren't in LA very long then?
I was in LA till 99. So I was there 91 to 99.
Oh, okay. That is a long time. I didn't realize it was that long.
But it ended up, I was spending so much time either when I'd have a break, I'd come home after like a Gloria thing, and then I'd go to Detroit and I'd, you know, rehearse with the Seeger guys, or I'd write with my buddy Craig, who was Seeger's keyboard player. So I wasn't in LA as much as, you know, I was trying to advance the next gig, yeah. You know, try to keep things moving. So yeah, like all my breaks that I would have, I would go back, and I was really through the years trying to work my way into the Bob Seeger gig. And his thing was basically intertwined. Even, before I did Exposé, I was starting to practice Seeger stuff with Seeger's band. So I hadn't met him yet, but I had met the band. So we started to work it in, and they wanted me to meet Bob, or Bob to meet me. And so that just kept going for a while, you know.
How did you get, you being from Detroit, I know is huge, because he's big. I mean, he's big on that, hometown guys.
Right. I mean, I was at the time I was in Miami when I started kind of doing stuff with them. And I don't know if, I mean, being from Detroit for me, it was just, you know, I used to go see Seeger when I was in junior high school at the arena, and just, you know, I was a big fan. And it's it's a very tight world. His world was very tough to get into. And so I had to go like step by step. So it was like meeting one guy in the band, and then Alto Reed, the sax player.
Yeah.
The first guy I met. And I met him on an airplane ride for Christmas break from Miami to Detroit. And he was going up there
randomly.
He was going up to visit his parents or something. And he lived here in Miami on Key Biscayne. He had a sax with him, like a little soprano sax bag. And I had my guitar. And I was like, oh, hey, you play? What's up? And he said, yeah, I play with a Silver Bullet Band. And I was like, oh, Adrian, great. I think I know you, Alto Reed. That's great.
What a funny name. So, I mean, it's obviously a pseudonym. But that
correct. It's like Alto Reed and Ivory Keys on keyboard. So I met him on that flight, and I remember he said, well, we're kind of looking for a guitar player. So I actually, when I got home, I went to a guy's studio and I recorded a demo, sent it to their office, never heard a thing, zero, nada. And this was like in 84 or something. Then in 89, I was registering for the winter, semester at UM, and I went to Ace Music to meet Steve Vai because he was going to do like a thing there. So my buddy was one of the owners there. He let me into the shop before, people were there, and Alto was there. And I recognized him. I was like, aren't you Alto Reed or the Bob Seger, right? And he was kind of like, yeah. I was like, no, I met you years ago on a plane. I'm a guitar player and, big fan, and just wanted to say, hey, and if you need any guitar for anything, let me know. And he said, yeah, I just finished building a studio in my house. Do you want to come by? Maybe we could do something. So then I started.
Did he remember who you were when you came by his house?
Pardon?
Did he remember that who you were when he came by, when you came by his house, that like the plane flight and the.
Well, this was at Ace Music when I met him the second time.
Right.
So the first time he did remember the flight. Maybe. I don't know. That was, 8 years ago or so. I don't know. So then he was getting scripts from his office because Seeger had done, a lot of movie songs, like for Beverly Hills Cop. And so their office is constantly getting scripts for movies. So Punch, Bob's manager, would, Alto looked at him. So I went to his studio at his house, and we started writing together and trying to write stuff for movies to go through the office. So nothing really came of that, although the office started hearing my name. And then my schedule was crazy because I was literally going to school all day, then I'd teach in a guitar store for like a couple hours, then I'd go to a gig. Back then you had gigs that were, five, six nights a week,
sure,
four sets. And I'd do that. And then days that I didn't have to teach, I'd go to Alto's and write or whatever.
Wow. So that was pretty hectic. Full
hectic schedule, but it was great. I loved it. And then we were in Florida. It was like maybe spring break or something. And he said, Seeger's band, those guys are coming down to vacation. Want to get together and play. Why don't you come and play with us, This was all without Bob. And so I did that, and we played a bunch of songs, and then we did Don Brewer was playing drums from Grand
Really?
Club. Yeah.
Holy
and then Alto,
shit.
Craig, and Chris, who were, all members of the Silver Bullet Band. So we did a bunch of things. We actually recorded a cover of American Band with Don singing, and we did a different approach to it.
That must have been cool to hear him singing.
Are you kidding? I mean, that was like the first 45 I ever bought.
Yeah.
It was a golden 45 Grand Funk Railroad American Band. And like, we're there in they did it at Alto's house. I had this riff, out on the road for 40 days.
The opening of that, the drum opening.
And then I watched him sing it, and he sounds exactly the same, and it's just, incredible for me.
That's
it's like
cool.
A dream. So, but I got to know, so those guys I got along with great. They were super cool. And so it just started the relationship, slowly working my way towards trying to get in the band, which was still years away and many gigs away,
So how did it finally happen?
Well, it happened very slowly. They kept, you know, like, I remember when Exposé played in Detroit, the bass player, Chris, was like, yeah, I got them to, they're like, yeah, we want Bob to meet you. He didn't come. That's fine. Then I think the first time I met Bob, he kept hearing my name. So he wanted to shoot a video in Detroit for The Real Love. So and actually I have a picture of it here of us in a line.
Oh, that's cool, man.
And that was, so we did a video. It just lip synced the video basically. And I think that's when I met Bob first. And then we he was contemplating touring. And at this point I was doing Gloria's gig. I was doing the Sound Machine, but I was coming back and forth to Detroit. And then we would go to Bob's house and rehearse songs and, you know, all his songs in a little room. And, you know, then, you know, piece by piece, he'd be like, hey, can you play this? Can you play that? It was super cool. So he was planning on doing a tour, which didn't happen. And I was in the middle of Gloria's tour and I had to like take off in 2 weeks. And we were sort of rehearsing with Bob for his tour. So luckily he didn't want a tour. He decided not to tour, but then he took me into the studio. So then we went to Nashville and LA. We recorded a ton of songs that he wrote. And I got he had me play on the Greatest Hits album, which was great. Greatest. And then that went on for a while. And Craig, the keyboard player, and I were writing a lot of stuff. We had a bunch of tracks, you know. And so the Greatest Hits album comes out. And then he wants to do a studio album. So we went out on Bob's boat. This is, I'm sorry, it's such a long story.
You went on Bob's boat?
Yeah, Bob's like a sailor. He's super into it.
Okay.
And we went out on his boat. Let's see. Are you there? I'm going to plug my phone in. So, and towards the end of the trip, it was like a 2-day trip. I asked him, I said, so what's up with the album? What are you thinking? And he said, I want to do some more writing. And you guys got some stuff, right? And I was like, yeah. Craig and I have some stuff. And he said, yeah, I'll hear it. Let's do it. And he said, I'll come down to Craig's house tomorrow and listen. And we thought, you know, probably not. But he did. He came down. He listened to a bunch of tracks we did, and he loved them. And then he went home and wrote a bunch of lyrics. And he came back. We had rehearsed and went in the studio and laid down a ton of stuff. And so ended up getting a few songs on that album. And
didn't you have a number one hit?
Yeah, I guess I think in the rock charts anyway was number one. Yeah,
and what song was that?
Lock and Load.
That's awesome, man. You know what's cool?
Yeah, for me it was surreal because I'm like, you know, staying at my mom's house, and you know, a limo would pull up and pick me up and take me to the Palace Arena to do a show, and it was like, what is going on?
But you know what's cool? You started this story talking about this cattle call audition that you had for Exposé while you were at University of Miami, and you're sitting in a room like with guitars, platinum and gold records. That's really cool. You know, that's the whole journey, man. You know,
I can't complain. I've been super lucky. But
yeah. I mean, I'm sure when you went on that audition, you weren't sitting there thinking this is what you'd wind up with.
No, but yeah, I mean, if you
maybe you did shit. Tell me.
Originally I wanted to be in Led Zeppelin. I wanted to form a band with four guys, and I'd be the guitar player like Jimmy Page, and we'd live in castles in England. So that's dream number one.
That's not a bad dream.
Being a sideman and doing those things is cool, but the original plan was, you know, to be the next in a band that is the next Zeppelin, basically.
When you were with Seeger, did he have another guitar player, like a rhythm, like a utility person?
Yeah, we took, we didn't in the studio, but for the tour, yeah, we took Mark Chatfield.
I was going to ask you, that was Chatfield. Yeah, man, I know him.
Chatfield, dude, yeah. Totally.
You know, it's funny. I just redropped his interview today because I put older episodes out once in a while, and it happened to be today.
I think he did like the last tour. He stayed on.
He did.
When I got, when I started working with Shakira, it became like a very all encompassing world. So, I mean, I was producing her stuff and writing and MDing. And then she and I took off for like a year to promote that laundry service record. And we'd go town to town, and I just have a, you know, a bag full of CDs with different versions of the single, the 2 minute 31 second, the 1 minute 30 second, the 3:30 second, all these, you know, all these versions. And then I'd pick up a band in each town to basically lip sync on all these TV shows and stuff. And that, you know, those were the days when you used to promote. And I like promo because most of the things happen during the day.
Yeah.
And then you're done. You're not waiting for like a 10 o'clock downbeat or something. But nowadays they don't, it just doesn't really exist because they can reach more people just
social media, Twitter. Internet. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Mm. I mean, and yeah, I'm sure promo's expensive. They used to, with Gloria, we would do promo and they would put us up in a hotel, like in Rome above the Spanish Steps. And we'd have everything covered, food, wine, everything. And, you know, that was a different world.
Oh, hell yeah. Definitely.
But a lot of fun.
When you went from Gloria and Emilio Estefan to Shakira, the Estefans were big, but Shakira was like next level big. I was curious, you know, what was that experience like as far as what adjustments maybe did you have to make, or like maybe what was the biggest crowd you played in front of and what was different about that?
I think the biggest crowd we played in front of, we did a free concert in Mexico City in that like largest square in the world. I think there were 500,000 people, which was pretty crazy. But even with Shakira in Latin America, we play stadiums. So there's always just, you know, it's a ton of people.
Yeah.
Not in the very beginning, but once the English album came out, then she started doing like stadiums, like that kind of thing in Latin America. And I guess, what was I going to say?
Adjustments that you had to make.
I mean, adjustments that it's hard to say. I mean, back in the day, like, you know, in ears, mm-hmm. what people wear on stage, they didn't really exist. Like when I was with Seeger, we all used wedges loud with Kenny Arnoff on drums. And it was like, you know, so loud. My ears were ringing every night. But it's difficult. Like the monitor engineer has to follow, because I was moving around a lot on that gig. And so the monitor engineer has to follow you through the wedges if you're doing a solo and you're going from one side to the other. And then you get the ears. And I love the ears because I can protect my hearing and I can adjust my level. But there's this disconnect
from the audience. It
takes a long time to get used to from the audience. Yeah. And it's very strange, but.
So you can hear nothing outside of music. You can't hear any audience at all.
No, you can hear them. I mean, you can hear them. It's just, it's muffled. I mean, you know, you're hearing basically, cause I mean, it's kind of cool cause you can hear the click track. You can hear it, adjust your mix any way you want it really. So that's great. Okay. And you can save your hearing. I mean, I did a gig with Coldplay, with Shakira and Chris Martin. They have no volume on stage, no side fills, nothing. So being on their stage was really weird because we use side fills because Shakira does a lot of dancing. So she likes to feel the thump.
Sure.
So you put side fills there. So at least you feel the beat and you feel the thump. And not having any of that is really strange.
Yeah.
So you've just got it here. There's only so much low end you can put in there. But you save your ears, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because Coldplay's music is more very laid back, not groove music.
Right, but a lot of rocking, you know, big, massive songs. Just I'm a definite fan.
Yeah, I love the band.
But what other adjustments? What are you thinking?
Well, I don't know. I didn't know what, you know, I was just thinking there had to be some sort of changes that you had to make. Like you just said, like the in-ear monitors and stuff like that. Was it overwhelming? Like when you get out in front of 500,000 people in Mexico City, man, that, like, what's the first thing you're thinking of?
I mean, I think it's super cool. The difference between an arena and a stadium, the stage is lower in an arena and you can kind of connect with people
a little
easier because they're closer in a stadium or something like that. The stage is higher and the people are a little further back and it just kind of becomes this just sea of people.
Yeah.
But the coolest thing we did, I think, Glastonbury, and we've done a bunch of Rock and Rios. Rock and Rios, we usually would close the night, so we wouldn't go on until 11 or 10:30, and it's dark. But when we did Glastonbury, it was during the day. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which I love.
Yeah,
because you see the people. It's like that Springsteen video, for Born to Run. You see the people. I love the daylight. Artists don't like the daylight because they don't have the lights and everything in their most dramatic effect. But for me, that's the ultimate.
Yeah.
Being able to play in the daytime, seeing a crowd react, incredible. We did the same thing we played Finland, went on it like in Helsinki, went on at like 10 o'clock at night, but it was light, bright as can be because it was summertime. So that was cool too.
That is cool. That's really cool. Any, what was the most fun or unusual experience you had on that gig?
On Shakira's gig?
Yeah.
Fun or unusual? I mean, there's been tons of fun. I have to think about that.
Well, let me put a different question because it'll incorporate that. Tell me the top three musical experiences you've had.
That's a tough one as well.
Yep.
But one for sure is playing, I think – playing like Hollywood Nights with Bob Seger in Detroit.
That's gotta be cool.
And, Night Moves, during that gig, I would look out at the crowd and I'd say to myself, it will never be this cool again. Just cause I, growing up listening to Seger and being a fan and then doing that.
Hometown.
And we probably played like 15 shows at the Palace or something, and
that's so
incredible.
Cool.
Biggest rush ever, and the crowd, his crowds are so loud and into it, and we sold all the way around, so there was crowd behind us, in front, everything. It was awesome.
That's so amazing that you got that gig. I mean, what are the chances?
And it wasn't easy. It took a long time.
eight 10 years of evolution on that. That's amazing.
It was. But he's the greatest guy, super nice, just the regular guy.
Yeah.
Like I remember staying at the Four Seasons in LA, and you see like Alto's downstairs tasting, some fine wine at the, and then there's a Domino's pizza guy going to the elevator. And he's going to Bob's room.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's just, he's him. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. And so cool. I mean, when we were working on the album, when I was living in LA, I'd pick him up in my Chevy S10 pickup at his hotel, and he'd help me lug my gear out of the back of my pickup and set up at, Henson or A&M, whatever it was then, Conway.
That's cool.
Nicest guy, super down to earth.
Very cool, man.
So.
All right, so that was number one. Give me two more.
That's number one. Two, I think probably the first show I did with Gloria was in Australia.
And, oh, wow.
We had, I didn't have the luxury of going through rehearsals with them, so they gave me a video because they were mid-tour, basically. So they gave me a video and a cassette, and I learned the show pretty much note for note. And then we went there and we had a sound check, but we didn't have time really to run the whole show. But it was, Sydney, Australia, I guess, incredible first, huge audience. And we, I think, did four shows there. She sold out everywhere. And I think, starting that John DeFaria riff of Get On Your Feet, which was the opening song.
Oh, they played the opening. That's cool.
Yeah, it was that was a definite moment for sure. And if there was one more, it's hard to say. Well, here's one thing. Here's a good moment, though.
Jeff Beck, Eddie Van Halen, and you?
Yeah.
What the hell? What is that?
That was in London. We were over there doing promo, and we were staying at the hotel. Anyway, sitting at the down in the bar, and I see Jeff Beck's like sitting a couple tables by. I'm like, oh shit, Jeff Beck's over there. I want to go say hey or something. And I was just getting up, and then Eddie walks in and sits down with Jeff, and they start talking.
Not too intimidating.
Introduced myself, and we started talking, and we hung out for a bit and did some shots, and it was awesome. It was like,
so they were just like really, they were open to you sitting with them and hanging out.
They were very cool. Just super
random. That's really cool.
And he's like one of the nicest guys. Just incredible. He's
wow.
One of the
Holy
greatest.
Crap. That's amazing. That's really cool. And that wasn't the days, was that pre-cell phone?
Yeah.
How'd you get a picture of that?
I think my buddy had a camera or something. Holy, or I had my camera.
Yeah.
But yeah, so much different now. I mean, yeah. To go through all my pictures and try to find pictures that I'm looking for, it's like, now it's another world. But I think that was in, yeah. I think Eddie was over there doing the OU812, one of those albums, the Hagar albums.
That's cool. Quite a great picture, man. That's not too many people have a picture of them with the two of them.
Of themselves. I have a picture of me with the Edge somewhere. I can't find it.
That's a better one. No, you're the one you have with Beck and Eddie's.
Random.
Yeah.
So random.
So you grew up in Detroit. What was growing up like there for you? What was your childhood like?
It was good. You know, I grew up in like a suburb of Detroit, and you know, I think fairly normal, but when I got into playing guitar so much, I was I was into a lot of different players. Like I learned every Zeppelin song I had. And back then, you know, you had a record player. So you got the needle and you got to like drop it and listen to two notes and then drop it. So I have a bunch of old albums that are scratched to shit.
Yeah.
I mean, Zeppelin 2, forget it. But then I started getting into, you know, I was just wanted to play guitar all the time. So I was really into Pat Martino as well. And I read an article on him, and he was like, I dropped out of school when I was 15 and I went to start music. So I was thinking, man, I need more time to play guitar. So that's when one of my counselors at the school I was at told me about Interlochen.
Okay.
And, but in, you know, in Detroit, I had, you know, garage bands galore. And, you know, back then you'd play anywhere. You weren't thinking about getting paid or anything. You're just, I want to play in front of people anywhere that I can.
Right.
So the music was pretty much, I would just play guitar, you know, either skip school to come home and practice or just all day after school. And then I started before Interlochen. At the school, I got out of some classes and I formed a band. So I used that as like a part of their curriculum. So they let me do that. And that gave me more time to practice. This guy kind of, rather than dropping out of school, I went to Interlochen, which is
great. Yeah.
It's great. You just, there's people, you know, artists and dancers and theater and musicians everywhere. No guitar players though. No guitar teacher.
Oh, I didn't know
that's
that.
That's why I majored in composition. And there was a jazz band
that
I played in. But there, I was kind of the only guitar player there. John was there before me. Same situation.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now they must have a guitar player, but I mean a guitar teacher. So I took, you know, some jazz studies class with a piano teacher there. And I really liked it. I liked, being around all these orchestral players, incredible, just, you know, disciplined people.
You're pretty disciplined, right?
And then you're in, you know, you're at this place that's in the middle of the woods in northern Michigan. So it snows about 6 feet starting, you know, November 1st. And you're just in, and it's normally a summer camp where they have a few thousand people. And then the academy in the regular school year, there's only 400 kids. So you've got this, you know, this whole area just to, that you've got rain over. So it was great. It was just so, you know, great to get up and then have a jazz band practice and then composition class and then jazz studies class. And then the academics were great as well and super inspiring, you know. It was very cool, and you're just kind of isolated so much. All you can do is, you know, practice. Looking back, I don't know if it's kind of too sheltered. It might be better to be in New York City or LA, like in, from the very beginning. You know what I mean?
Let me ask you this. You're pretty disciplined, right?
I hope so.
No, I mean, you have to be. I mean, you're not, you can't do all these things haphazardly, right? I mean,
right.
And you're pretty driven. Where did that, those two things come from?
I know that's a good question. You know, I don't know exactly. I mean, I was, kind of, I don't know. I think I just wanted to prove something. Maybe, you know,
to you or to like your dad or mom or something.
I don't know. Probably to myself and to everyone. You know, I'm kind of a short person, so I didn't have a lot going for me for sports. Although I played tennis, but you know, I was one of the short kids,
right?
Kind of thing. So guitar for me and music became like a great outlet and a great way to express myself and, like, you know, I'm going to be the best at this then.
Interesting.
And my dad was a doctor and his dad was a doctor.
Oh man. So
both
you had
orthopedic surgeons, both orthopedic surgeons. And my grandfather was like the president of the Orthopedic Society. And he was Henry Ford's doctor and he was Charles Lindbergh's doctor. And, you know, so my dad followed in his footsteps and, which was great. I mean, we used to go to the hospital and hang out and ride around in wheelchairs, but I never, was never my thing. My dad was always very cool, both my parents, about me pursuing music, you know.
That's very unusual because when you have, in my experience in talking to people, when you have people that are like academics or academic oriented, they're usually not, they're the specific people that are typically not cool with that.
I know. I know.
That's
I was lucky with that. And, you know, thank God that I did become successful enough to not have to, you know, you reach that point where you're like, I'm going to have to ask my parents for money because I can't pay the rent. So once you cross over that permanent ledge, like, you know, it could have gone worse.
Yeah.
And then I would be very bummed, but, they were great. You know, we had a fairly dysfunctional family, so there were a lot of issues.
Does that, who has a functional family?
No one. I know.
I'll talk to you'll meet somebody once in a blue moon and they're like, man, you know, my parents were loving and this and that. I'm like, really? What the fuck was wrong with them?
It's true. Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's like, you know, oh, and you almost like walk away. Like, there's something wrong. There must be something going on.
That's, it can't be real.
Yeah. Come on, man. You're in denial. What really happened? You know?
Yeah, man. That's like a whole nother story.
Well, let me ask you this, to the extent you're comfortable. My next question is, what were some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with and how'd you get through them?
In music and
no, personal life, not music or whatever you want.
I mean, a lot of stuff. You know, my brother was kind of messed up. He died when he probably shouldn't have. And
no, I'm sorry, man.
A lot of, you know, things like that. A lot of crazy, you know, things. And it's funny, you know, I grew up on a block that was pretty cool. Like all the parents hung out and everything, and it was in the 70s. But it all just fell apart. I mean, it's just like divorce and someone killed themselves. Some divorce, someone got that. I like my friend hung himself. This guy OD'd. All this, like, you know.
Holy crap, man.
Reality.
That's heavy shit. So you. Well, you know. Yeah. Wow. So music got you away from all that, too.
Music did, and I was my sister and my brother both. You know, when I was back then, before I played guitar, it was about, you know, music, about having what albums you had and what know. So I'd save my money, I'd cut lawns and shovel driveways or whatever, save enough money to go. And then you'd buy, like, you know, the new Deep Purple album that was $5.95 and bring it home. And that was the greatest. And then finally, I started like on a $10 nylon string guitar and had a few lessons. And then, but once I got my first electric guitar, then I started every day.
Yeah.
And it took a while. I mean, I don't feel like I'm naturally talented, but I worked really hard and I practiced constantly. So I think that's, you know, I know guys who are like Andy Timmons, who's just like, can just throw down. But
for me, but I got to believe he's got thousands and thousands of hours.
Of course. You can't avoid that. There's no one who's like, what? Guitar, it's easy. What? Like,
yeah.
You can't get there without that. But I was very disappointed. And then also, you know, when you're in that practice mode and especially at a place like Interlaken, you're reading books on Buddhism and Zen and, you know, it's kind of cool. Like you try to model yourself after your idol. And like Pat Martino was one of my idols at that time. And that was his thing. You know, he was like into I Ching and stuff. But, you know, in the high school years, that's when you really get into all that stuff, right? You read all those books, philosophy. And especially in a place like that, when you have dorm rooms and everyone, you know, gathers in someone's dorm room and you talk about all that stuff. It's all philosophy and art and Zen. And then I started doing yoga at a very young age up there. And so we had this whole like thing happening.
It's like
which was very inspiring.
It's really inspiring at that young of an age to have that, to be open to that many different channels of potential things to do.
And just the environment was so conducive to that kind of thing, you know, to just, a lot of discipline and a lot of exploring.
Yeah, that's cool.
So the overall attitude there lend itself towards that mindset, which was, it was great. For me, it was perfect.
Yeah. I mean, did you stick did any of those things like stick with you, like either the Buddhism or like yoga or anything like that?
Yeah, I still do yoga. I was,
that's cool.
I don't do it as much, but I either go to the gym or I do yoga about every day. And when I was in LA, I was doing yoga every day with this intense teacher. It was great.
Greco.
Greco. I haven't done yoga with him.
He's a teacher. He teaches.
I know.
Yeah.
He taught a few classes on the road.
Did he? I'm sure.
Sure. Yeah, man. He's great. He's still carrying the torch.
Oh, totally, man. He don't miss a day. Yeah. We talked about that.
He's a funny guy and he's a super nice guy.
Yeah.
I miss him.
Yeah.
He was great to have on the road for sure. Man.
It's interesting. I had a troubled childhood and that was my response too. I worked. I just, my thing was at school and I was obsessive about it. That was like I didn't know what it would do, but that's how I channeled myself.
Mean, I was, you know, I took on this music thing and I was really afraid of disappointing like my dad and my mom, you know, because they dealt with my brother and all these crazy things that happened. And I just didn't want to be that guy. I was like, had to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I feel extremely fortunate at least to have,
you did it,
you know, that they don't have to worry.
Yeah.
At least, you know, but,
your family still in Michigan? You still have family in Michigan?
Well, my mom passed away a few years ago. My dad is in Kentucky. My dad's in Lexington, Kentucky. Mm. And he's doing great.
Good.
He just turned 90.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really good. Fuck, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. That was cool.
Hey, man.
Any things, if you had to go back and give advice to younger Tim, assuming you would have listened, anything you might have told yourself that would have made life easier?
Well, I don't know if it would have made life easier, but I would have told myself to be the singer and sing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's when kids start learning guitar, they want to get into it. I'm like, sing, start singing, because the toughest thing was always to find the singer.
Yeah.
You know, why couldn't I have been Peter Frampton, who's like the guitar player and the lead singer?
Right. Right. It's funny you mentioned Deep Purple. I have Ian Paice coming on like next week.
Holy cow.
I know. That's how I feel. I'm like, holy shit. And I had Mark Farner on. I was the same way. The first thing I said to him, man, I said, Mark, I'm 15 right now.
Exactly. Dude, my friend Craig Frost, he was in Grand Funk.
Was he?
With Secret Now, but he was one of the main guys in Grand Funk in the heyday. And he tells me stories. They were the last band, I think, to stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel because they threw TVs out. They did the whole thing, the stereotype, trash every room, throw things through the window.
That's pretty funny, man. I didn't know they were that out of control. All right, let's talk about gear for a minute. I know you got some very cool guitars there. What is your go-to guitar right now? Has that changed?
You know what, I hate to say this because I do a lot of Gibson stuff for sure. But this is a guitar that James Tyler built for me.
Yeah, sure.
Years ago. And he built me, it's the second guitar he built for me. At the time I was living like right down the street from him, from his warehouse. And I asked him if he could build me just a straight up Stratocaster. And with a maple neck. It's my first maple neck. And it was straight up Stratocaster. So that's what this was. And it's got Fralin pickups. And it's just got a vibe and a sound. Whereas the first one that he built me, not so much.
Interesting.
But this is pretty much my go-to guitar.
I thought he was in England. I didn't know he was in.
This was in the 90s. I probably built this for me like in 90. Or something.
So he was in LA?
Like 93 or 94.
So Miami?
He was in LA. He had a place. His shop was on Sepulveda.
Okay. Interesting. I thought they were in the UK. Very cool.
But he's, this was a long time ago. Since then, I think he got into like Variac or something, a bunch of various.
They still build those.
Endorsements. What's that?
They still build Strats.
Yeah.
But still both shots. I don't know.
They're not all. This one's special for some reason. And then I've got like, I don't know if you've seen these. This is a cool guitar. This Vondre.
Yeah, it's an Italian guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, talk
light
about
as
that.
A feather.
Yep.
It's the strangest thing. And it plays so evenly.
What is that made out of? Wait. Come back. What is that?
I think it's plastic.
Yes, it's a Wandre, Wandre, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and look at the neck. Like,
wow. It still looks like an acoustic guitar neck. Yeah, the headstock. Okay,
so he's a violin builder, or was.
And what is that sound? Okay, so those are Wandre pickups.
Yeah, you got this pickup selector here. And all his guitars are different. This is a very tame-looking one.
Yeah.
A lot of them look like drip castles. You know what I mean?
How does that sound? What does that sound like?
But it's like, I've got a bad string on here, but it's the greatest thing. The low end, there's like no boominess in the low strings. So it's so even. It's unbelievable.
And you've recorded on tracks with that?
I have, yeah. It's a great, middle of the like. It's that guitar. It's the jangly.
That fretboard looks brand new. Is that a new guitar or
no? This is, I don't know what you're. Another guy owned it, and I found him online, and he was kind of a semi-famous dude, but I can't remember. I lost it a while ago. But this is a very interesting guy here. And then this one is This is a 70 Strat that I kind of butchered and put EMGs and a Floyd on it, of course. But this one has had the most hours on it. And I kind of have retired it to a certain degree. But this was the one that it belonged to a buddy of mine when we were in junior high school. And then he sold it to me like when I was in college. And it's just it's a great guitar. It's
what you're, it's a Strat, a conventional Strat?
Fender it's a Strat? 70 Fender Strat, yeah.
What
kind of big headstock
with the floor? What do you normally play? Because I noticed the last two you picked up were like Rosewood, and then the first one, the Strat, was Maple. What's your preference?
I guess it just depends on the guitar. Like okay. I've got a Jaguar 65 Jaguar that's got a Rosewood neck. I've got a Tele. This this is like a Nocaster custom shop.
Sure, sure.
But literally, like, out of the box, just, like, you know, it's I tuned it to the Rain Song.
Sounds great, man.
Yeah, have you ever tried, you know the Rain Song?
Yeah, by Zeppelin, of course.
Zeppelin, yeah.
So beautiful song.
Google it. They use this different tuning, which makes it way easier to play. But it's pretty ridiculously genius.
Beautiful song, man.
And I've got a 59 reissue Les Paul. I had one thing I regret is selling a 1961 SG Les Paul.
What you needed the money at the time?
Yeah, I don't even want to get into it. But don't worry, I actually traded it for something ridiculous. It's too embarrassing.
No, it's all good. What are you playing through usually, like in the studio and then also on stage?
I've got like a Bradshaw rig that he put together. He's done my stuff since like 89. So I've got divided by 13 head with a 412. I've got an awesome Bogner Shiva combo. I've played a bunch of those, and this one, for some reason, sounds has a little bit more character than any of the other ones I played.
Man, I hung out with that guy at NAMM.
No, I've never met him.
No, I hung out with him at NAMM. He's fucking hilarious.
What's his name? Like Rupert
Reinhold.
Reinhold, that's right.
Reinhold Bogner. Yeah, he's like off the charts funny. He's like Borat come to life. Right? He looks like him, and but he's really funny. He's a very bright, very bright guy. Really smart dude. Very, very soulful guy. He's just hilarious.
And he builds great amps.
And
I do have a custom audio head, mm-hmm. one of the first ones that Bob made, and I've got a Marshall 100 watt. So I think like my Bradshaw rig has the custom audio. I've got like a three, basically my setup is stomp boxes up a center speaker, mm-hmm. and then stereo effects left and right.
Okay.
So it's three speakers.
Yeah. That's a lot. That's a lot of maintenance, man.
Well, Bob sold me on it a long time ago, and it's great to have that direct signal and then have just the transient delays on left and right. So I've got, you know, drawers with a bunch of stomp boxes that I swap in and out depending on what I need. And the thing like with on Shakira's gig, it's always been, I need a lot of preamps. Because every song has a little different amount of distortion, a little different. So I've got like a Soldano, one of those purple preamps, Soldano one I got in 89.
So everything is pre-programmed, all these different.
Well, no, that's all manual. So that's the problem.
So like, you have to adjust that every song.
I just have a bunch of, I've got an Egnator preamp, a Soldano preamp. I've got two channels in the custom audio. And then I've got, you know, five different distortion pedals. And so it's just, there are a few things, like you can see over here. This is just my, you know, little pedal board, but there, like, you see all the dots are different settings from the tour that my tech would come in and be like, okay, song number two needs to go there, da, da, da. So there's a bit of that, but I try to cover it all with, you know, with trying to avoid that.
Yeah, that's a lot of work, man. Wow.
I mean, that that Strat, the Tyler Strat, through, I've got one of those self-sustains, Pete Cornish.
I don't know.
You know that. Those?
No, I don't. Hey, pick put your phone angle back.
Oh, sorry.
No, I can't see your face. Yeah. There you go.
Sorry.
Thanks, Tim.
No problem. It's this British guy, Pete Cornish, soft sustain pedal. It's a big box that I got probably in 2000. But that, if I put that Strat through the back pickup through that thing, it's just like, it's amazingly squishy yet clear.
That's such an English name, Cornish.
It is. He's British. Yeah. He builds pedals. He does a different thing. He takes all the pedals' guts.
Right.
And puts them into the board. At least he used to do that.
Oh, okay.
So he builds his boards that way, whereas Bob's thing is basically just a switcher. And I do have one of these fractal units that I have yet to figure out exactly. I know they're super flexible. It's just I so much prefer turning knobs than going for another page and, you know.
No, I get it. I totally get it. Yeah, it's also what you're used to.
True, but my goal is to try to use that on tour, and that, because my rig right now is just so big.
I'm thinking you got to have like a half of a trailer, or at least a third
it's
of a trailer.
It's like one refrigerator, and then one case for two heads, and then I've got these amplifiers to power the effects only kind of thing. And that's another rack. And then I've got this huge guitar trunk that's like one of those coffins that travel with no case, right? The guitars just lock in there. It's great.
Yeah.
So the tech doesn't have to like get a bunch of cases out and deal with all that. But it'd be definitely scaling down could be.
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier, man. Holy smokes.
But I got to be convinced. But a lot of people are. A lot of people who know how to use those seem pretty happy.
Yeah. I know a lot of people, quite a lot of people. I got to tell you, most of them are not our age, probably. It's a little easier to adapt to technology.
And they know all the tricks.
Yeah. It's like, man, do you have kids?
No.
Yeah. Well, I have three kids, and it's really interesting. My two older ones are 28 and 30. My daughter's 20. When she was... And my son has come to me and said, I'm so happy I didn't grow up with a cell phone because I can talk to people. And like, I remember when she was a kid, 14 or whatever, 15, the three or four girls would be in the room and they'd all be on the phone talking to other people.
I know. It's
like
John told me the same thing about his kids. He's like, he comes downstairs. There's three there. There's two sons and one and a girl. They're all on their phone.
Talking to other people.
Dude.
Right. Yeah. It's very
That's
weird.
Where it just gets too cuckoo.
It's a little weird, man. Yeah. It's a little weird. I learned like.
It's like, I'm here, but I want to know what's happening out there.
Oh, yeah. It's not being present to the exponential degree. Yeah. It's the ultimate in not being present.
Powerful tool in so many ways. Yeah. It's scary.
It is scary.
Especially your kid. And then it's like, what did someone say about this and say about me? And I said this. And did you see my... It's all about that.
Yeah. Well, thank God I'm through that stage. So, but yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Unfair question. Favorite musicians you've played with?
Shoot, man. I mean, all the guys in Shakira's band have been playing with forever. Brandon Buckley and Albert Menendez and a bunch of different bass players that we've had through the years that have been great. Greco was great. Kenny Arnoff.
I had Kenny on the show. He's pretty intense.
All the guys in Seeger's band. I did, you know, with Gloria, we did do... she hooked up with a lot of different artists. Yeah. Like Emilio would combine. I mean, he's just a, you know, a genius as far as putting things together. But so I did play like Bridge Over Troubled Water with Paul Simon.
Wow. What so was that? Like,
check.
That was my amazing. First record I bought.
Like amazing. And he was cool. You know, I rehearsed with him. He was like, I trust you. You're okay. And I hear, cause I hear my buddy Andy Snitzer plays in his band regularly. And I think Paul's not the easiest guy to swing your way.
When was this?
This was for, Hurricane Andrew.
94. Yeah.
Plowed through Miami, yeah, sure did, and Homestead.
I was living in Broward at the time.
Emilio did a hurricane relief concert.
Yeah. Okay.
So Paul Simon was one of the artists. So,
oh, that's cool.
You know, Gloria and we were kind of the band to back him up. And then Stevie Wonder, I did some stuff with, which was incredible. But again, that was kind of like through Emilio, like throwing these superstars in the mix. But Stevie's like, you know, in rehearsal, you're playing and he'll do it one way. And then the next time he'll go higher and do something different every time. It's just like, and it's all amazing and perfect.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Ray Charles. We did a one-off with Ray Charles or something. And he was, you know, there's these guys like I also got to work with Tony Bennett a little bit. And these guys who have that maturity level, like Frank Sinatra level of feel.
Yeah.
Like even Julio Iglesias, he has that feel. I mean, these guys, these older guys, it's another world, you know? And Seeger, amazing guitar player, but rhythm guitar player. Like, I cannot play night moves like him.
That's interesting.
I can't. And he picks up the guitar, just like, it's wow.
Who took over after you in Seeger's band? Not Rob McNally.
No. I think Chatfield did.
He picked up lead?
Played lead guitar after I did.
Okay.
And then Bob started getting Nashville guys. We recorded a lot in Nashville. He likes a lot of the Nashville guys. So I think that's been his kind of go-to thing. And the only steady guys, you know, are Chris, Craig, and Alto, like the main guys.
Chatfield.
Chap Chickens.
Chatfield, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if he's still got his store in Vegas.
No, he just opened and he doesn't have... Does not have that, but he recently got back into the business because I saw on Facebook he's
in Columbus or in Vegas.
He's living in Vegas, lives in Vegas, so it must be there, then, I don't think it's just brick and mortar though. I think it's all online now.
Oh, no kidding! Yeah, because he had a pretty sizable shop in Vegas for a while.
Yeah, in fact, the guy who turned me on to him, I think, was Frank Sidoris, who's Slash's guitar player, and he bought he knew Mark because he was, you know, one of the guys in his store. He's from Vegas. Yeah. So I think he's doing
those guys, those like dealers, like they're on to everything.
Yeah.
There's no more, finding the old lady who's got some like 54 Les Paul triple pickup custom that she bought her son and he never played it and she found it under the.
No, that's under gone. The bed. I know. You don't see it's, that much.
Amazing.
Do you remember the first record you bought?
Yeah, it was the Edgar Winter Group. They only come out at night.
Great record, man.
Tell me about Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Free Ride.
Give me your top three Desert Island Discs, man.
See, that's a really tough one for sure.
Just for now. Just for like this minute.
I think I'd have to say like Sgt. Pepper's probably. I would probably also have Joyous Lake by Pat Martino, which is just one of my childhood memory things. And then maybe Seeger's Greatest Hits is a really tough question, but Pet Sounds is amazing. But I'd say those little Beatles, little classic rock, little jazz.
All right, Matt, that's a very tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Like most about myself? I guess being able to defuse a situation and being able to mediate situations and smooth things over when there's a problem.
That has probably served you well in your career, as especially as an MD, and as you got your hands in so many.
I think, yeah, pies, you know, that's probably the, you know, I mean, for me, I think that's the most important thing. You got to, you know, if everyone's comfortable and everyone's cool, then it's going to work out. You're not going to be able to push someone to do anything better by being a pain in the ass or being an egocentric, narcissistic prick. You know, there's no power in being like, I'm the guy and, you know, this is how it goes and it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
That's not me at all.
Yeah.
I'm more like, you know, some of these, and, you know, producing is another thing that I've learned. Everything, you know, as you get older, like songwriting and producing, because in the beginning I was a songwriter or whatever. You write a song, you get something, oh, I love it, it's so cool, and the artist comes in and they're like, I don't know about this part of that. No, but it's so great. Wait, no, I don't want to change it. Now I'm just like,
next,
let's try something else.
Yeah.
And same with producing. I learned a lot, like from people like Phil Ramone, who would basically just kind of let the, you know, if you bring in a session bass player or guitar player, just, you know, go, let me try something. It's probably, you know, just play with it and see what happens.
Right.
Like pulling the best out of that person rather than being like, here's the chart I made and here's the exact notes to play. And this is, which I'm, you know, I'm into that as well. And that's where I go back to if I don't get something fresh and new out of someone, but just the idea of, you know what, just do what you feel first.
Yeah. So you become,
know? And
you,
then from you, there, cause you might run into something incredible.
Yeah.
You know, did you see that, I think a recent Motown special or something?
Which one?
I don't know, but it, within it, can't remember who's talking, but one of the producers, maybe Smokey, is talking, is doing recording My Girl. And he said, like, he put the track, what he had up, or they were playing around, and the guitar player started joking and just strutting around the room going, do, 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 as a joke.
Was that Steve Cropper? Who did that?
Maybe I'm not sure, but then, you know, I think Smokey, if it was him, he was like, no, that's it, we're doing that. And the guy was like, come on. And hey, that's being a, I think that's it's not an easy thing to do, but I guess once you get to a certain level or whatever, letting people bring their personality in is the only thing really that the audience or the listener relates to,
right,
is someone's interior personal experience and that coming through whatever ideas they have. And then if the ideas are no good, then you can try something else.
But you're more, as you've gotten older, you're more open to this now.
Totally.
Yeah. That's good. Less willful, less stress, man. I feel you on that.
Totally. I mean, yeah, it's just, It becomes too frustrating, especially with writing. If you can't let go of something, you're just going to be frustrated. And anyway, it's there's situations that are pretty funny like that.
Has your life been different than what you imagined?
Probably. I don't think I expected to live in Miami like most of my life.
Are you there for good, you think?
I don't know. Could be, but I'm, I don't know. No idea. I really miss the North and the seasons, and I think I need to get a place.
You know, it's interesting. Even here, we have winter.
You guys do. You have leaves semi-fall off the trees. You can smell autumn.
You have to wear jeans and a jacket. You know, when I lived in Plantation, January 1, I remember January 1st, walking my dog 7 a.m., I had to wear shorts. It was oppressive. So we have
oppressive.
It was, man. We have, you know, we have summers are not, you know, they're hot, But we have winters. It's nice, man. Yeah, you have.
That's what I loved about LA.
Yeah, you got some seasons. Yeah.
Jackets, jeans.
Yeah, it's nice. It feels good, you know. I don't care.
Cold weather. It gets down here sometimes, you know. We've had weather in the 40s, but it doesn't last.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? I get back to Michigan quite often.
Oh, that's good.
At least before this COVID happened. So usually I try to get up to Detroit, and then I drive down with my sister and see my dad and back
to Kentucky. Times that's a year. Good. That's nice, man.
So I get my fix.
Do you have any hobbies outside of music, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to cook a lot of different food. I like to cook Indian food, Italian, sushi.
Man, that's a lot. You're a good. That's the number one musician.
That's my favorite side project is probably cooking.
That's the number one hobby for musicians.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
It's funny how as a musician, you start cooking stuff at a young age and you make things like hummus and stir fry. And like, but as again, like I used to cook, you know, like an Indian curry, and I'd add tons of carrots, every kind of vegetable and whatever meat. That doesn't fly now. Now I'm very, I try to go as traditional with any dish that I cook. So it's funny. Back then I would just add whatever. And now it seems like sacrilege.
There you go. Yeah. It's a number one hobby amongst musicians. Favorite place you traveled?
Favorite place. I think I like Italy. All over Italy. Rome's incredible when it's not super crowded. But, I mean, I think that would be number one. I like the Pacific Rim was really cool, too, like the Philip Manila and like the outskirts, you know, in the woods and the – and then Machu Picchu. We went there once and incredible. I mean, so that's not one place. It's tough.
And that's tough. Hey, two more questions. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Well, one tough decision I had to make professionally was I did the pilot for the George Lopez show.
Right.
And if it would have gotten picked up, I was the MD. George was great. We did the pilot. If it was in 2008, if it would have gotten picked up, right then it would have been perfect. But then like 2 years later, no, that must have been like in 2006. Cause 2 years later, nothing happened. I ran into George. I was with Shakira at the Lincoln Memorial doing the Obama inauguration event. Right. So I'm with Shaq and I run into George, and George is like, "Hey man, I think we're going to get picked up this year." And I'm like, "Awesome. That's so cool." And, so anyway, it took a little while, but I started putting Shakira's next tour together, was into that already. And then I got the call, like, the Lopez thing is happening. Can you please, you know, do it? So I had to make a decision as whether to do Shakira's tour, which I'd already kind of was semi up and running for rehearsals, or bail completely and go, you know, move to LA and do George's show. So I ended up staying with Shakira and doing that. And I think George's show lasted 2 years and our tour actually lasted longer. But I still wonder what would have happened if I would have done it and stayed out in LA after that, because it would have been kind of a shift in career scenarios. So that, you know, that was a tough one.
Yeah,
for sure. And I don't know whether he says I did the right thing, but I don't know if I did the right thing.
Interesting. Yeah. So that's cool that you're still in touch with him.
I'm not that much anymore, but right around when the show was happening, we were still in touch. And
well, you had a whole thing going with Shakira. You'd been with her for a while and you had
Yeah, that's the thing. It was a lot. It's sort of all encompassing to a certain degree, because writing and producing and touring and
MD putting the band together. I mean, you know, you're kind of like the point guy.
And it's kind of easier. It's just, I know what to expect. I know her so well. I know what to do. I can do it. It's easy. But the other thing would have been a shift in career. So who knows? You know, maybe I would have gone from that to another TV show, which I love that idea because they film in the daytime. And then you're
like, oh, okay. Yeah.
And you're home and you're like,
I would think you made the right decision because I've interviewed a bunch of guys that had steady gigs out there, like working for Jimmy Kimmel, Conan. All those guys getting rid of the bands.
Really?
Yeah.
Not Kimmel. Kimmel's not.
Jimmy Kimmel isn't, but everybody else is banned. You know, even in the, what's his name? Jimmy Vivino I had on here.
Right.
Toshi Inagi. He's with Jimmy.
Toshi does the Kimmel show.
Yeah, I know Toshi. Yeah, he's good. And then there was somebody else I had I've had just too many people on in too short a time. My brain's jello. But yeah, so I think you probably did the right move, man.
Yeah, there's not that many. Are they doing DJs? Are they doing sidekicks?
I just don't think people give a shit about music enough to make it a thing.
There's too many options.
Yeah. You know, you get one guy on there spinning. It's been a 12-piece band or 8-piece band. You know, it's like
it solves everyone's problems.
Yeah, yeah. He don't come in, boom, get the next guy.
I know. It's the band. Go on.
No, I'll say the last question is what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of that change has been intentional and how much has been a natural part of aging?
Well, I think it's kind of like what we were talking about as far as how I approach different situations. If I'm the boss of something or I'm running the music portion of it, it's kind of like I want everyone to feel comfortable and everyone to be happy and everyone to be happy with each other. I'm not saying that I don't, if there's a problem, I have to deal with it.
Sure.
And I have no problem doing that. Or, but I think just maybe maturing a bit as far as that, just dealing with people and situations and trying to, keep people less crazy.
So Tim 2.0 is more chilled out.
I think so. I mean, I hope so. The thing is, I'm chilled out, but I don't sit still for long. Unless maybe I'm practicing or something, but I don't sit down and, watch TV without doing something else at the same time.
Yeah.
So the thing I like about MDing in a way is because I'm always busy.
Yeah.
If we're taking a break, the band is on a break, I probably need to go talk to the artist or deal with something else. Always something happening.
Sure.
So I like that. I like being basically tossed around like that.
Good, man.
And it feels kind of just feels normal to me. However, I've done, a few things where I'm not the MD and there's something to be said for that as well.
Just doing nothing and laying back.
It's your problem, not mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. Well, that's a good problem to have, man. Both sides.
Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, it did totally. Hey man, let me tell people what you got going on. Talk about that cloud above your head.
Right. So the cloud, I think we're calling it Cloud 13. This is the prototype, the first one we built. And it's basically a SoundCloud as far as functionality, but it's also a cosmetic deal.
So when you say SoundCloud, you mean for the buffering the sound in the room?
Right. Yeah. It serves that purpose. It's got the proper foam for all that. Underneath the cloud exterior is virtually only cosmetic. But the newer ones that we're making, we made one for Shakira. We made one, I think, for...
Who's we?
Well, my buddy and I. His name's Quaz. He's trying to do a one-name thing, Quaz.
So. Yeah.
But...
That's good. Like, if you don't have a good memory...
Up to the phone, the... Newer ones are hooked up to the phone and they create storms and they flash and trace like lightning. It's really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. We're, all right, so if somebody wants to get a SoundCloud,
they can reach me at
Instagram.
Instagram.
Yeah, okay. And you can find Tim on Instagram at The Real Tim Mitchell.
That's it.
Dude, you should have like a whole, you could see, I could see a whole lineup of these.
I know someone wants us to build one that's 7 feet by 10, I think, which would be the biggest one.
That's massive.
We built one for this studio here that's called Rebel 11, which is bigger than this one. But yeah, hopefully.
You know, the world's first cool designer project. SoundCloud, man. That's
all. Yeah, and it works, you know, I mean, it's great in the studio, but you can also home theater, whatever.
I could see that, too, especially in a town like Miami, man. That's the, right up the alley, you know.
Yeah, I wish this one performed, though. This one just kind of sits there.
Like, makes thunderstorms.
No, the new ones, you can program all kinds of different events, basically. Like, you know, it'll flash or it'll lightning, you know, kind of spider web kind of things and different.
That's cool.
You can have a whole, you know, barrage of programs.
That's
that
cool,
you
man.
Do with your phone.
Well, dude, good luck with that. Everybody, you can check that out. And if you're interested, go to The Real Tim Mitchell on Instagram. Also, you have a Tiny Audience TV show coming out. You want to talk about that?
That's what's coming up next. And that is going to be filmed here in Miami. It's an HBO show. And it's pretty cool. This is season 2 for them. I did a little bit on season 1, but now they're going to put basically a house band together, very small, and basically like an unplugged thing where each artist comes on and they sing maybe 3 songs, and one might be their favorite song or something. You know, there's a theme to each
is it song. A contest? Like,
no, it's not a contest. No. Imagine that. It's not a contest.
No. So what it like, what's the point with,
it's kind of like a story. It's kind of like a storyteller's thing.
Okay.
You know, they tell how they made the song or whatever.
Okay.
So there's, basically an interview. You get the artist, they interview, they sing a few songs, and that's pretty much it. I think there may be some more surprises this season, but I'm only dealing with the music, so I don't know any of the details as far as what's going to happen, but that'll be on HBO.
And you're MDing and you're playing guitar?
Yeah.
That's very cool. Who else is
in
your band?
That's pretty much an acoustic thing.
Who else is in the band?
That's what I'm putting together right now. But I think Albert from Shakira's band is going to play keys and percussion. My goal is to have a lot of interchanging parts. Hmm. So there's this guy who's an amazing percussionist, Gilmar Gomez, who plays with Enrique Iglesias. He's Brazilian, but he plays guitar really well and percussion great.
That's cool.
Albert can play keys and percussion. And I've got a guy, Mike Scaglione, who plays bass and also plays woodwinds. So
That's
with that combination,
interesting combo, yeah.
I can mix things up quite a bit.
Yeah, that's good, man.
So it'll all be like an acoustic, unplugged kind of scenario.
I wish you a lot of luck. I hope the show does well, man.
And thank you, man.
And also, if you want to work with Tim either in a production capacity, or if you want to have him play some tracks on any of your records, hook up with him through his Instagram account, which is again, The Real Tim Mitchell. You know, send him a link or something. He could get a feel for what you're doing and what your interest is, and, you know, just talk to him. And so give him enough information so he could respond and, you know,
awesome.
Give him some kind of thought. And, that's about anything else you want to promote.
No, I mean, that's it. I thank you for having me.
No, Craig. Man, thank you. I appreciate
great
your time.
To finally cook up. You're a busy guy, man.
Yeah, a little bit. I am. I'm like you. I like to be busy. I'm better now, but I remember one time, it was kind of terrible, actually. It was a little jarring. About, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, I came downstairs. We live in a different house, and it was like 6:30, 7 o'clock, and my 3 kids are there and my wife. And they all turn around and look at me and they're like, "Dad, are you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah." They're all like, "What are you doing here?" And I was like, this is a problem, man. I got to work less. Yeah, it was a huge problem. So yeah, I'm busy, but I'm a little more, I'm much better. I'm much more well-rounded now, but yeah.
Hey, good for you on both fronts.
Yeah, it's a work in progress, man. Hey, listen, yeah. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Let me wrap up here and I'll talk to you in a minute. And thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it, Tim. And best of luck with your projects. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Follow Tim on Instagram at The Real Tim Mitchell. If you want to connect with him for either production or tracks, of which he does tons of, message him through Instagram. Check out his show on HBO coming up next season, A Tiny Audience. And if you want to buy a SoundCloud, that's the thing that's right above his head. Reach him again. Cloud 13. Yeah, reach him on that and so he'll put something together for you. Give him a challenge. And thanks, Tim. I appreciate it. Everybody, most important, man, especially nowadays, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.